can't please everybody.
Call the House Committee on Judiciary to order Wednesday, February 8th, 2012, 5 p.m. Also, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 4085, announce that that bill will not be heard tomorrow. Those can testify today, and it won't be the bill that probably moves. Representative Gilliam is going to conduct the rest of the meeting. He insists on having the gavel. We're going to let him have it.
Do we get to vote on that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to open the House Committee on Human Services for February 6, 2012, 5:10 p.m. And I want to thank the my committee, of course, and I want to particularly thank the Judiciary Committee and the co-chairs for joining us for this hearing. I want to open up a public hearing on House Bill 4084, and I'm going to ask my co-chair on the work group around this bill, Representative Hoyle, to come forward along with the author of the bill and these latest -2 amendments. Police from Ledge Council to come on up. While they're coming up, I want to quickly say this. If you will bear with me and focus on the -2s to this bill, I would really appreciate it. That goes for everybody who's going to testify. We've got a lot to get through, and if you're not interested in focusing on -2s, you're going to make me very unhappy. We've covered a lot of water, give me a cliche. The water's under the bridge, and we're moving ahead. So that's what we're focusing on, and I hope that'll make it clear to everyone that's what we're doing. So with that, my good co-chair on the work group, Representative Hoyle, will you kick us off?
Hi, thank you so much for staying late and being here to listen to this bill. We felt like it was really important to have both our Judiciary Committee and all of our lawyers, who I have a great deal of respect for, along with our Human Services Committee, hear this bill. And for the record, my name is Val Hoyle. I represent House District 14, West Eugene, and Junction City. And I'm going to be here to answer questions, and I'm going to hand you over to the certified smart person, the person that wrote this legislation.
Thank you. Representative Krieger, Co-Chair Krieger, Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Tomei, members of the two committees. I am Melissa Seidlick, Deputy Legislative Counsel, and I did draft both House Bill 4084 and 4085. My understanding is that I was asked here this afternoon to provide a very quick section by section go through of House Bill 4084 with the -2 amendments. So hopefully you will have in front of you both a copy of House Bill 4084 as well as the -2 amendments. So with that, I'll begin. Right off the bat, Section 1 has been removed from the bill by the -2 amendment, and that is no longer my understanding that's no longer a part of the moving target.
And then, Section 1 would have created a crime of felony assault for abuse of an elder, and we took that out because there were concerns about moving forward with that in this particular bill. So that's been removed.
Thank you. Section 2 of the bill is on page 2. Actually, the substance of the change to ORS 131-125 is on page 3 of the bill. And this has not been amended by the -2 amendments. It extends the statute of limitations for prosecution from 3 to 6 years for certain listed felonies on page 3 of the bill. Where the victim was 65 years of age, or might still be, or older. Section 3 of the bill is on page 4. It also was not amended. It is a simple conforming amendment. Section 4 amends ORS 137-225. The substance of the amendment appears on page 6. Basically, it provides that a defendant cannot move to set aside a conviction for criminal mistreatment in either the first or second degrees if the victim was 65 years of age or older. Sections 5 through 10 have been amended by the Dash 2 amendments. They appear on page 8 of the bill, and I'll try and track where they are changed in the Dash 2 amendments for you. Section 6 would add a section to the elder abuse reporting statutes that would require health care providers to permit law enforcement to inspect, copy, or obtain protected health information of an elderly person that is the subject of an elder abuse investigation. Now, the original version of the bill included permitting not just law enforcement, but the Department of Human Services. The Dash 2 amendments removed that provision, and that's on page 1 of the Dash 2 amendments, lines 8 through 15. Another change that was made in the Dash 2 amendments, an important one, appears on the Dash 2 amendments, lines 14 through 15, that those lines authorize the healthcare provider, upon request of the law enforcement agency, to consult with the persons in the agency about the health, about the protected health information. And that was necessary because as originally drafted, it would just permit the inspection and copying of medical records and not the speaking with the healthcare provider that is sometimes so essential in these investigations. Section 8 is also amended in the Dash 2s. It basically is the same as Section 6, except that it pertains to residents in a long-term care facility where an abuse investigation is taking place. The Dash 2 amendments also authorized consultation with the healthcare provider. Sections 9
and I do want to point out one of the reasons we changed this the last time we came in front of the Human Services Committee. There was concern about having the department, DHS, having access to this information, so we changed this to make sure that only law enforcement who was involved in an investigation of abuse would have access. So it is not, so again, we took the agency's access out of that to address some of the concerns.
Thank you. Section 10 appears also on page 8 of the original bill and is amended on pages 1 through 2 of the Dash 2 amendments. This is a new provision that would go into the financial records provisions of the statutes. It would add a section to those laws that would require financial institutions to disclose and provide copies of financial records of a person, either an elderly person or a resident in a long-term care facility, where they are the subject of an abuse investigation. The statute requires that, and again, this one is also limited to just law enforcement personnel, and the provision in the bill that the Department of Human Services would be included in this law has been removed by the Dash 2 amendments. This disclosure takes place upon the certification by the law enforcement agency about a number of things that appear on page 2 of your Dash 2 amendments, lines 19 through 26. Basically that the person whose records are being sought is the alleged victim in an abuse investigation, that the law enforcement agency has a reasonable belief that the abuse has occurred or is occurring, and that the requested copies of records are necessary for a determination in the investigation. the statute would allow the financial institution to notify the person whose records are being requested about the request unless directed not to do so by the law enforcement agency. And the financial institution can request reimbursement as well. Section 11, thank you.
Lisa, hold on just a second. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Co-chair. Witness or counsel, reasonable belief of commission of a crime, what's the nexus between that and probable cause? If there's a reasonable belief that a crime has occurred, that's probable cause. So, in other words, the law enforcement agency must show probable cause.
Representative Hicks and members of the committee, co-chairs, actually, probable cause is more associated with criminal investigations, and this is a type of abuse investigation that takes place in by a law enforcement agency, but in the context of civil statutes. And so often those refer to reasonable belief as opposed to probable cause. And I am not a criminal law expert, so
I'm looking at it.
We'll defer to.
This is a critical. I mean, this is a critical point. I think on the bill that we need to flesh out, not to derail your testimony at all here, but I think it's a good point. I mean, so currently, to get a warrant, we need probable cause. So it sounds like to get access to these records, we need probable cause. Does that thread sound?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I know from the days when I worked for a federal agency on administrative issues, it was reasonable belief. I don't know how that translates to criminal law and probable cause. They sound pretty similar.
With co-chairs, all the respective co-chairs and Representative Hicks, we've got the district attorney coming up to testify, and we'll have that information for you.
Thank you.
Thanks for holding for Representative Shoffler.
Thank you. How does this disclosure of this health insurance, health care information conform with federal HIPAA laws? And if we can do it for 65-year-olds and older, why wouldn't we be able to do it in any case? And can we now?
No, but this language, it's exactly the same as the language we use in child abuse investigations, so it's exactly based exactly on that language. Because what we're trying to do is with elder abuse for vulnerable adults, not saying that every elder is vulnerable, we'll call them chronologically advantaged, but at the end of the day, for elder abuse, we wanted to align it with our child abuse statutes and align it with the ways that our child abuse and get investigations are handled, because those are handled in a much more efficient and effective manner.
So it does conform with federal law.
Yes. Thank you.
And we went through that in our work groups.
Okay.
Good.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenlee.
I'm still puzzling this over, since you define everybody over 65 as elder abuse. If law enforcement wants to get access to my bank records now, do they just have to go in and declare these things, or do they have to go to a court and get a judge to believe them that these things are true under the current circumstance?
Representative Greenlee, co-chairs, members of the committee, there are a series of statutes that permit. You're talking about financial records or health records?
Well, I'm talking about either, but let's say financial records now. Let's say law enforcement now wants to get access to my financial records as being vulnerable because I'm older than 65. Would they have to make these declarations? Would they just have to go to a bank and make these declarations? Or would they have to go to a judge and get a court order to have access to it?
Yeah. Yes, Representative Green Lick and members of the committee, there are a series of statutes pertaining to disclosure of financial records by financial institutions, and there are a number of them that address various situations. Some of them are criminal investigations, some of them are administrative proceedings, some are trying to verify persons that are receiving public assistance and their account status. And there are different requirements in each of those statutes as to what the requester has to certify to the financial institution. But currently, there is not a requirement in an abuse investigation. And that is why this Section 10 has been drafted into the bill.
Thank you. And colleagues, we're going to get through, you have a few more sections to cover on the dash twos. We're going to need to get through those, so I'm going to hold questions. There's a lot more context here, and we have some great folks to enlighten us. So please go right ahead, and we'll finish this part.
Great. Thank you. Section 12 of the bill is on page 9, and it pertains to confidentiality in abuse investigations. Section 12 would allow the Department of Human Services to provide names of witnesses and records that have been compiled in the course of an elder abuse investigation to certain entities and individuals as listed in this bill on pages 9 and 10. It's a rather long list, and I won't elaborate on it, but this clarifies that the requirement for confidentiality does not extend to these individuals under this statute. Section 13 on page 10 is the same as Section 12, but pertains to confidentiality in abuse investigations pertaining to residents in long-term care facilities. Section 14 on page 10 of the bill, the original bill, creates the Resident Safety Review Council. Section 16 repeals the council, sunsets the council on June 30th of 2013. And what the council is created to do is to review information it receives from the Department of Human Services under Section 15 of the bill regarding abuse investigations. And they are to then perform what is called a root cause analysis to determine whether these incidences of alleged abuse are acts of abuse or adverse events. And I think I did indicate that there's a sunset on that of June 30th, 2013. Section 17 of the bill, page 11, the substance of it is actually on page 12, and it provides that public funds cannot be used to employ a person who provides support or care if they have committed certain kinds of crimes. There is a new exception that has been carved out in lines 9 through 24 on page 12 of the bill that would provide that for certain crimes, 5 years after conviction, that person can be eligible to be employed in a position of care, and they can go through the whole process of getting a criminal records check and getting a fitness or a determination of fitness, and are eligible for appeal of that determination if needed. The crimes where that exception is carved out are public indecency, private indecency, invasion of personal privacy, theft one, theft of services, and computer crime. So just for those crimes, this exception has been made.
Pardon me?
Not that I know.
Okay.
Section 18 on page 13 of the bill clarifies that a person that is prohibited from employment using public funds, as I just described, is not entitled to a determination of fitness or appeal of that determination. Apparently, that was an administrative hitch that needed to be fixed, and a clarification that should be helpful. Section 19 of the bill is on page 16. It is basically the same as Section 18, but this statute applies not to state agencies who are making determinations of fitness, but to defined qualified entities who also require criminal background checks to employ certain kinds of individuals for certain kinds of care positions. This also clarifies that persons who have committed those crimes that appeared previously in Section 17 do not have the right to a determination of fitness or appeal of that determination. Section 20 of the bill is on page 18 but has been deleted by amendment. In its place, Section 21 of the bill on pages 18 through 19 has been amended to require the Department of Human Services no later than October 1st of 2012 to make a report to this legislature about implementing a statewide call system to provide a means for making the elder abuse report required under the elder abuse reporting statutes. Sections 22 and 23 pertain to a requirement of the Department of Human Services that it provide training and continuing education curriculum for people other than law enforcement personnel who investigate allegations of abuse and who provide care to vulnerable persons, and that they make a report to the Legislative Assembly no later than October 1st, 2012, about the implementation of that training. Section 24 has been deleted by the amendments from the bill. Section 25 on page 19 of the bill reinstates the Elder Abuse Work Group so it can continue and complete its work until June 30th of 2013. And that is the basic substance of the bill and the Dash 2 amendments.
Thank you, and I thank you for that overview, and I hope that's helpful. We're going to get into some of the issues as we go, as we move on, and I'd like to thank Melissa, and I hope my co-chair on the work group will stand by, but I'm going to go ahead and ask three people to come on up and share with you. I'd like Duke Shepherd, policy advisor to our governor, to come up, and if Patty O'Sullivan, Kevin Christensen, and Pam Levitt are in the room, I'd like them to come up. While they're coming up, colleagues, bear with me for a moment, because I want to make sure, particularly for our judiciary folks, that you have the context, and I will be brief. But this started with the Adult Safety Protection Team, and I have in my hand 37 recommendations that came out of that group. I went to some of those meetings, but not all of them. This was a major move on the part of the department to bring the stakeholders together first. So that's what this started with. Then you will remember we had a task force that came out of the last session, and that's what Representative Hoyle and I are reporting on here tonight. I'm going to just take you quickly through the participants, and I'd like you to also pass down the supporters of this bill so you have that context as well. In the work group, and you see him right there, Senator Przanski, and thank you for being here tonight, sir, along with Representative Hoyle, myself, and Senator Winters were involved. But here are the others. Detective Matt Smith from Forest Grove, you're going to hear from him in a little bit. John Wentworth, the Clackamas County Assistant DA. Lark Wisham, from Citizens Bank. Gail Gustafson from Credit Unions. Jeff Brandon from the Governor's Commission on Senior Services. Brady Scott from Heritage Place Assisted Living, who came three times from Bandon at his own expense to be part of this. Grover Simmons from Independent Adult Foster Care. Jeff Aiken from the department. Lauren Rhodes from Oregon Healthcare Association. We really have, you know, enjoyed being with her. And Fred Steele from the department, as well as Mary Yeager, the state long-term care ombudsman, Jerry Cohen from AARP, and the Honorable Judge Catherine Tennyson from Multnomah County. That's just the group that we pulled together, and there were others that came as well. I think that's important for your context to remember the work that has gone into this. We have heard this twice in our committee, and I will stop talking now and ask Duke if you'd go right ahead.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, thank you. For the record, Duke Shepherd, I'm a policy advisor to the governor, and I just want to thank Representative Gilliam, Representative Hoyle for their work, and the committee in the interim that did all the work. And I'm just here to say that with the dash twos, per Representative Gilliam's request a little earlier, I sincerely hope the bill finds its way to the governor's desk so that he can sign it. Thank you.
Thank you for that. And if you'd go ahead. And just for everyone to move things along, you need not, is this okay with you, Madam Chair? We need not identify all co-chairs. And in fact, this is a very respectful group. I trust you. Go ahead.
The respectful joint committee members. Pam Levitt with the Northwest Credit Union Association. I sent you all my written testimony. We were thrilled to participate in the Elder Abuse Task Force. As I said in my testimony, from 2 to 5 million Americans suffer from financial abuse, from financial abuse. And so in credit unions and other financial institutions, we work very hard to train our staff to acknowledge and see this. We participated in the work group to share the kinds of things that we see in financial institutions. Department of Human Services came to us with the proposed language, and now the new amendment, which takes them out in the dash two, we do support that, and I just wanted to let you know that we stand ready to continue to talk about this issue and help solve some of the issues we're seeing. Thank you.
Good evening. For the record, my name is Patty O'Sullivan. I represent the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and we're here to positively support this bill and the Dash 2 amendments. In a hospital, as you know, we would see people that have been abused and otherwise hurt. Sometimes the reason that they are hurt are given as they fell or whatever, and then we find out that and figure out that they have been abused. Law enforcement officials and officials, investigators of DHS come to our facilities, and right now, because of HIPAA, we cannot give them records, nor can we speak to them about the injuries that we see and observations that we've made. HIPAA, Representative Schaffler, does have a stipulation in it, exemptions that states can adopt laws for vulnerable people and for children and their records, and this would actually take care of that, because up till now we've been very frustrated that we could not share medical records and information with law enforcement and investigators of DHS. So we're very happy to support this, and we stand here to answer any questions or help you in any way we can, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Pat.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Kevin Christensen, Government Affairs Director for the Oregon Bankers Association. Thank you for allowing us testify. As with our colleagues at the credit union, we are very active in our banks in terms of training and getting our frontline staff especially aware of issues relating to elder abuse. We have put together a package of materials that is actually well known throughout the banking industry on a national level to help prepare people in the midst of revising those, and we'll be happy to share them with the committee once that time comes about. We are in support of the bill, the Dash 2 amendments. We would prefer to have DHS in, candidly, but we are supportive of the bill as it is. We've moved forward. This is something that will help prevent elder abuse. We take this very seriously, and our bankers are very concerned. We appreciate Representative Hoyle, Representative Gilliam's leadership on this particular issue, and I'm open to any questions. I do have a banker with us. If there are questions the individual committee members have, Betsy Steinberg of Pioneer Trust Bank here in Salem is here to answer if there's any perspective that she can offer. So thank you.
Thank you, and I appreciate that testimony, particularly because when you first start looking at elder abuse, you first are concerned about the physical part, and then you quickly get into the financial part, and your people, as well as those at the credit unions, are the first line of defense. It's a very tough area, and you've helped us go through a minefield that I think at least we have a beginning at doing a better job, both training and detection. I think my co-chair has a question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Co-chair. So, Kevin, you sort of slipped in there. You wish that the part regarding DHS was not taken out. Did I understand you correctly? And if so, could you elucidate?
Co-chairs, Representative Tomei, yes. It would be our preference to DHS. There's a provision in the law, 192.586, subsection 2, that permits financial institutions right now to initiate contact with law enforcement, DHS, of their own volition. DHS, I believe, my understanding, short of a subpoena, can't come to us and say we want records. However, our financial institutions can, if they suspect elder abuse in the financial context, can in fact initiate contacts with law enforcement. And again, that provision is found in 192.586, subsection 2.
Follow up, please.
Please.
So are you saying this new law would take that ability away from financial institutions? Not.
No, we would. Okay, co-chairs, Representative Tomei, no, it would not. And okay. We would probably be running around the building on fire right now.
Thank you, Kevin. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, I'm going to thank all. I got a question over here. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and chairs.
And you're next.
I'm trying to get my hands around this thing here right now from the criminal investigation side of it. And I guess I have a little bit of concern here that if I'm the investigating officer and I show up at the scene of a residence and one of these elements of the crimes, you know, one of the crimes are identified here, you don't have a problem with me not getting any consent from the victim to go to you and seek out information, Kevin?
Members of the committee, Representative Olson, let me see if I can answer this from the point of view of, we can initiate, if you were to come to us in an investigative capacity and say, we need the records, we think something's going on, it's my understanding, as current law, you'd need to have a subpoena of some sort to move forward. However, if our bankers, let's say frontline staff, and see something over, let's just take the context of, sir, someone comes up to the counter and there are two large people behind them, and it's pretty clear what's going on as far as this is an awkward situation, the person is fumbling, nervous. There are different things that, again, a lot of these staff are trained to see. They're going to probably, the bank staff's probably going to take some time to look into that beyond just what's happening at the counter. May take it back and internally see if there's been some unusual transactions. And if the behaviors or the consistent behaviors rises to such a level, they may very well find it necessary to contact DHS or law enforcement and say, listen, we've got this issue pursuant to the statute and authority that's in statute right now. We would turn those over. And so that's, I think, what we're interested in terms of the DHS, and I don't mean to go far afield here. We can do that right now with DHS, and in a lot of ways we'd like to complete that circle and have DHS be able to contact us and speak on those issues.
And Co-Speaker Pro Tempore, let me just tell you that in addition to that perspective, we've got a DA coming, and you may want to hold that, and we'll get back to it. Is that all right with you?
Yeah.
All right. Representative Shoffler, then we'll get to it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kevin, I really appreciate what you're doing. The banks have had a public relation nightmare over the last few years for a lot of reasons, and you've been the whipping boy for a lot of people trying to climb political ladders, and I doubt this will be on the front page tomorrow that, you know, bankers have a heart and are warm and fuzzy and help and protect seniors, but I just wanted to thank you for all the work you're doing. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry if I missed the explanation, but it looks like the DHS was in the original and has been removed. Can you shed light on why that decision was made in the amendment?
Co-chairs, Representative Garrett. I would be speculating at this point, but I would answer in just saying that it would be our preference if they were included.
Is there someone who can speak to that?
My co-chair would be perfect for that.
We removed DHS because of concerns that were expressed to us about agency people having unfettered access to records, and, you know, either health or financial records, and the people that we spoke with were much more comfortable. We worked on that in 2013 and set some really clear guidelines and boundaries and, you know, around when DHS and who in DHS could have access, but that law enforcement in the course of investigation, it made sense that they could have access to this information. People felt more comfortable with that.
And Representative Gilliam, I'd like to also throw in for those of you who questioned. It was, DHS was also in our section of the bill for health care facilities, and we, too, supported that highly. We're kind of stuck when we're mandatory reporters and we report the abuse, and then when DHS shows up, we can't show them the records. And it was the same thing with police officers, and we'd have to say, sorry, go get a warrant. So it's very cumbersome. It's not, you know, we have to report, but then we say we can't help you. So it's a little odd, and we too will, if it comes back again in 2013, we would be extremely supportive of putting the abuse investigators on that list of people that we can give records to.
And that is one of the conversations we want to continue to have. But we need to move on with this bill. If there's no other questions, I'll dismiss this panel with my thanks and the thanks of the group. Mr. Co-Chair Barker, do you want to call any other?
David Pendanke and Gail Meyer, please.
Thank you, Co-Chairs, members of both committees. I'm David Pendanke, Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon. We're not aware of the work group and the work that had been done during the interim, and I can only say we don't catch everything. The first we knew of the issues that are of concern to us in this bill was when we saw the printed bill. I do have the dash two amendments. We've tried to analyze those on the fly this afternoon. But let me just start by making some general comments. Our concern here, and I'm speaking on behalf of the ACLU, is that everyone under the terms of this bill, and as we understand the way the current statutes operate, everyone over the age of 65 is presumed to be a vulnerable person for purpose of accessing these very private medical and health records. And as I'm listening to the testimony today, I'm learning more about the existing statutory structure relating to mandatory reporting and how those situations are handled. As I understand the current statutes, there are safeguards in place. These records are requested or subpoenaed or subject to a search warrant based on the review of several steps. Number one, there's a report to an agency, to DHS, or to some other recipient of a mandatory report. Number two, there is some preliminary investigation of that report. Under the terms of the Dash 2 amendments, as I understand them, there is no requirement that there be a prior report. As I read the Dash 2 amendments, Section 6, 8, and 10, a law enforcement officer on their own initiative can go to a healthcare provider or a financial institution and make a demand for these records. There is no oversight. There is no review after the fact. And my concern is for people who may be subject to this process if these provisions become law that are not victims of abuse. Their privacy has been compromised, and there may be no record kept by anyone that their records were accessed unless those records inappropriately are made public or turned over to someone who's not who's not authorized to have those records. And there is no remedy in this bill if those records are later disclosed. There may be no way to backtrack who it was that received the records from law enforcement, if indeed it was a law enforcement officer. So that's the major concern we have with this proposal. We want to be sure that there are safeguards in place. We understand the rationale for conforming procedures that are used in cases of child abuse to cases of elder abuse, but we don't think that analogy flies for every person over the age of 65. Our statutes in Oregon, at least in the area of employment discrimination and discrimination based on public accommodations, provide a presumption that there should not be discrimination based on age in this state for anyone over the age of 18. If someone is 65 and they're fired from their job merely because of their age, not because of their performance, they can go to court. They can file a complaint with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Not everyone over 65 is a vulnerable person. We want to be sure these procedures are limited to situations where there is, where it is more likely than not that the individual whose records are obtained is in fact a victim of abuse. A reasonable belief, as some of you started to question earlier, in the criminal law, I think the most analogous provision is in the stop and frisk statutes, which permit a police officer to stop someone and frisk them and ask them questions if the officer has reasonable suspicion that a crime has been or is about to be committed. Now, that reasonable suspicion standard is generally described as more than a hunch, articulable facts that lead to that suspicion. There is one other place in the police statutes that I'm aware of where a reasonable belief or reason to believe is used, and that's in a statute related to the collection and maintenance of records by law enforcement agencies relating to the political, social, or religious activities of individuals or organizations. Law enforcement in Oregon are prohibited from either collecting or maintaining such records unless there is reason to believe that individual or that organization is involved in criminal activity.
Co-Chair Barker. Mr. Dink, thank you for your perspective, and I appreciate you coming tonight. It is unfortunate that your organization wasn't involved or aware. You had a very...
I can assure you, Mr. Co-Chair, that we will be as...
And you had a very able representative in Andrea Meyer, and I find it difficult to believe she wasn't aware because of her competence. I also met her replacement, who also seems to be very competent. She apologized for your lack of participation until this late hour. As you heard, we're going to continue this work, and we'll look forward to your perspective as we move forward.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I will confine my comments as Co-Chair Gilliam requested to the Dash 2 amendments.
Thank you.
In the time since this bill became aware of the bill, I've been doing a lot of reading on privacy laws. I've been looking at the federal laws to make sure that I understood a corollary of how we were gauged with respect to them, both in medical records and in financial records. And I must say that generally, I've always seen one of two procedural safeguards in play when it talks about government getting access to medical or financial records. Either
there has to be notice to the person that their records are being sought and given an opportunity to object. And if the government wants to forego giving the person notice, they have to go get a court order allowing them to forego giving them notice. Or you have judicial oversight at the outset. You have a search warrant, or you have a grand jury subpoena, or you have a judicial summons. But I don't really know of an instance when both of those safeguards have been eliminated. And that basically is what this bill does. It allows law enforcement, the line officer undertaking the investigation, to go up to the reception desk, represent or certify, but represent, I'm undertaking an investigation, thou shalt give me the records now. There's no judicial oversight before and after. There's no agency oversight by way of superior's knowledge before or after. And there's no independent determination allowed by a medical provider or by a financial institution as to whether or not this is in the best interest of their patient or their customer. I'd like to stress two things. Number one, this does apply to everyone over the age of 65, vulnerable or not. And this is a fishing expedition, meaning the officer does not yet know whether or not the elder is suffering from an infirmity or from abuse. These records can be obtained even over the elder's objection. So if there were, assume the following, assume that there was a report of suspected financial abuse, the elder's account is depleted. The officer could go and seek a release from that elder. Would you please sign a release so we can get your records? And the elder says, no, I'm fine. The officer could still go to the medical provider and say, give me the records, over this person's knowledge, lack of knowledge or objection. It could be that the medical provider knows this person has a gambling addiction. This is why their account's depleted. And I don't think it's in my patient's best interest for me to share this with law enforcement. This medical provider would have no basis to independently withhold the information or to tell the law enforcement officer to go get a search warrant. So this can be secured even over the objection of the individual, and it can be done without their knowledge. With respect to medical records, I want to address a few points specifically with respect to Section 6 and 8. I want to address up front the suggestion that it's that these procedures are really nothing new, because this is what's done in child abuse investigations. I'd like to point out the following. In Oregon, it's Oregon law, minors under the age of 18 are not equipped to govern and control their own affairs. They can't get married, they can't have contracts, they can't start businesses, they can't vote. They can't do things that elders, adults, can do. And it's because of this state policy that they lack the maturity, both in their brain development and their life experiences, that they're not equipped to conduct and look out for their best interests. That's not the case for people over the age of 65. So while we may have these procedures in place for people, children, suspected of child abuse, it doesn't mean, in our view, that you can necessarily transfer that to people over the age of 65. People over the age of 65 do have wisdom, they do have life experience, and they do have the ability to control their own affairs. Number two, I think it is important to take a look at HIPAA. HIPAA is no limiter here, in that HIPAA says if it's required by law, then the medical provider can give it. And so by requiring it by law, this would be okay by HIPAA. But it is important to take a look at HIPAA, because as a national standard, what HIPAA is saying is, generally on matters other than child abuse, just for abuse investigations, if law enforcement were to come up to someone and say, can we have your records, HIPAA says the medical provider can use the medical provider's own professional judgment to decide whether or not it's in the patient's best interest to share this information with law enforcement, and whether or not they should give notice to the patient that the records are being turned over. This bill Again, I'm not saying it would violate HIPAA. HIPAA says if it's mandatory, it's okay. But I'm thinking that, quite frankly, as a national perspective, we're also foregoing any oversight or any safeguards by letting a medical provider independently decide if it's in their patient's best interest. Again, the medical provider may know something that law enforcement doesn't know, and they might conclude they don't want those records to be seen by law enforcement. Thirdly, and this is a bit in the weeds, but I do think it's important, with respect to the medical records, on page 3 of the Dash 2 amendment, there is a new provision that was not in the bill, and that's 7B. It starts on line 17, or 19, rather. I think what the original bill basically said, law enforcement can get the records of the elder. What subsection B, I think, is trying to do is trying to get joint account information. If the elder has an account at a bank and there are two names on it, what subsection B now says is that the officer can get the account information even though there's more than one name on that account. The wording, however, is quite broad. I think it's larger than simply joint account information. The other thing I would say is, if in fact the other person on the account ultimately were to ever be charged with a crime, you would have needed a search warrant to get this information. With respect to the financial records in Section 10, we do have pretty good statutes already. ORS 192-603 says basically that financial institutions shall provide police, sheriffs, and district attorneys with a statement about account activity in response to their specific questions. 192-603, procedure for disclosure to law enforcement agency. When a police or sheriff's department or district attorney's office in this state requests account information from a financial institution to assist in a criminal investigation, the financial institution shall supply a statement setting forth the requested account information with respect to a customer's account specified by the individual. And it's limited up to 2 months prior or since. But there are provisions in our laws right now, and I don't understand why those haven't been working. I don't think that 192.603 has necessarily been something that the law enforcement community has been using. But I would submit that the provisions that we have in this bill, in the amendment, 6, 8, and 10, go way further than anything that we've had to date, and I would urge the committee to have caution.
Thank you, Ms. Meyer. Mr. Co-Chair, if it's all right with you, I'd like to move on to our next panel and thank these folks for their input. I would love for Detective Matt Smith, who participated, as you know, in the work group, along with Annie Schoen from the Multnomah County DA's office to come forward. And I think this will be of particular interest to some of the questions and issues that came up earlier. Please come up and identify for the record and enlighten us.
Members of the committee, my name is Matt Smith. I'm a detective with the Forest Grove Police Department. It's also a privilege to have served on the governor's work group regarding this bill. I wanted to respond to several issues that have arisen that I've been listening to in the audience, first of which being the fact that I want to reiterate that what we're seeking here in these records are records pertaining to victims. And in many cases, these victims aren't able to tell us the victims. In virtually every single elder abuse case that I've investigated, these individuals have advanced levels of dementia. Whereas if any one of us was physically assaulted and at a hospital and needed assistance, we could just merely communicate with the investigating officer that there's something wrong and that we need assistance. When you're dealing with people with advanced cases of dementia, these folks cannot communicate with you to articulate that they are the victim of a crime. This is a core issue in elder abuse investigations that we need to fix. Also,
talking about me, Michael.
When we look at the way we respond to child abuse investigations, if we were to go up to Emanuel Hospital tonight, if I were to be called out at 2 o'clock in the morning tonight, I would respond up to the hospital, maybe come in contact with a 5-month-old child with a broken femur. I would be able to have conversations with medical staff, access to medical records, to try to determine whether or not this injury is suspicious in nature or a crime, or whether or not it was just purely an accident. And if I start receiving information as time goes on that maybe so there was something suspicious about how this injury occurred, the information that I've gathered from talking to medical staff and communicating with them about the medical records may lead me to obtaining a search warrant to search somebody's home to confirm whether a crime or not has been committed. The reason I use that as an example is that I want to respond to several comments, and I hope I'm pronouncing his name right, that Mr. Fedenke mentioned about a complete lack of oversight. That is completely not true, and I can explain why. Number one, if law enforcement is brought in to get access to these records in the first place, an abuse report has already been made to the Department of Human Services. We are then contacted in law enforcement and review the allegation to begin with. Number two, we then go to the financial institution and advise them in writing that this is an open investigation that was initiated by the Department of Human Services. We provide them with a case number. We provide them with the scope of what we're looking for. And maybe as an example, there's a $25,000 check that was written on a particular date that is extremely suspicious in nature. We also include that this is for the purposes of the victim and that the records we're seeking are germane to our investigation. This isn't going into the bank and asking for a large case of financial records. This isn't a fishing expedition. This complaint came from likely an outside source, like a loved one or caretaker. And then when we do receive a document from the bank, maybe a digital copy of this suspicious check, the next step in the process is then to probably complete a search warrant affidavit using that information and then delivering it to the district attorney's office for review. Just getting the first step of the process, like a copy of this check, is not the end, it's the beginning. And that beginning is using that document to then complete a search warrant affidavit, which is judicially reviewed, that's part of due process, taking it to the DA's office for review, and then getting a search warrant for the records. And again, to use it as an analogy, these are steps that are already taken currently when we investigate child abuse. We don't go up to Emanuel Hospital at 2 o'clock in the morning, find a child with a broken femur, and then immediately write a search warrant to get access to medical records to find out how this child was injured. And I'm in no way trying to correlate elder abuse and child abuse in the sense that these are two different issues that our society is facing, but we have a streamlined process that really works on child abuse cases, and we should take lessons learned from that and apply them to elder abuse cases. You're not going to see police officers going into banks without any report being made on their own accord and just taking boxes of financial records out. And number two, when and if we are investigating an abuse allegation, there's going to be police reports that are written. There's going to be review by supervisors, by sergeants. These reports are going to go over to the district attorney's office for review. So there is absolutely going to be review of actions taken regarding elder abuse investigations. And lastly, one thing I'd like to echo, which I heard already, is that medical professionals and bankers are the frontline people that we're getting reports from right now. Just last week, I actually got a phone call from a bank in our city. I responded to that bank and got a stack of documents from them that included right now about $300,000 in suspicious transactions. The bank provided me with a full statement, provided me the records, gave me all the information that I needed, and I'm in the middle of investigating that right now. But if I had been the one to go into the bank and notify them of the $300,000 in suspicious transactions, the bank can't talk to me. And to me, I have a hard time wrapping my mind around why we don't have that protection system in place where we can work in tandem with bankers, with medical professionals to address this problem.
Mr. Chair, we have a question over here.
Representative Frederick, go ahead.
I understand your frustration with this. Let me tell you my frustration. I understand the physical issues that you're concerned about. The physical abuse issues are a different thing, in my view, than the financial ones. A reasonable belief regarding financial components, what this does not say within this document, what you are expecting as a reasonable belief, going down a particular procedure. It may sound just outrageous for someone to say why should you not trust that you're not going to have a line officer come in and say I'd like to find out what's going on with this particular person. But there's nothing here that says that will not happen. I mean, I'm sorry, as much I'd love to see this. If there's a way to say this is not going to happen, we will not allow someone to just walk in and say, I have suspicion and I want to have the financial records of this particular person. Is there a legal component that's in here that says that, or is it just the phrase a reasonable belief that we're relying on? I'm serious. I don't want to have anybody I've got 5 years to hit 65. I don't want anybody to suddenly say, you know, we really need to find out what's going on with the financial records of Lou Frederick right now, and just be able to go and do that. So I want to. That's part of the concern that I have. Help me understand how this is actually going to be effective.
If I were to get a report from the Department of Human Services that an allegation came in that there was an enormous amount of financial irregularities on a person's account, the first step on that is beginning the actual investigation, which should determine whether or not there's any validity to what's being alleged in the first place. Was there even a transaction? Does this person even have an account with the bank? Going out and meeting the person directly and having a conversation with them. The first step in the investigative process isn't likely going to be going to the bank and immediately asking for records. One of the reasons why the medical component records, which is also discussed in this bill, is so important is that if somebody does not have dementia and they simply want to give people money, that's not a crime. That's not something the police are going to be involved in. And I get reports from Adult Protection Services already where they're concerned that a senior citizen is writing checks or giving money to people. And I've had to tell them, this isn't a crime. If this person has capacity and they want to give money to people, they can certainly do that. So you're going to see is that if I go out, for instance, on an investigation and meet a senior citizen who clearly has some sort of dementia or medical issue, and then you compound that with the fact that we have family members and loved ones giving statements that their money's disappearing, the cash isn't there, bills aren't being paid, they likely have dementia, then you would likely see a police officer then trying to obtain these records. So that wouldn't be the first step in an abuse investigation.
Representative Frederick, do you have a follow-up? I have a follow-up. I'm going to say this again. And I really just need to have something that shows me within this bill, something that says it's not going to be up to, that it's going to follow the process that you just talked about in terms of DHS, somebody calling in and saying DHS is doing this, that there's an investigation that has been sponsored or created. Am I missing something in here? Is that there and I'm just not seeing it?
Section 10, subsection A, talks about that the person about whom copies of financial records are sought is the alleged victim in an abuse investigation, which is defined under ORS 124070, right. And it also references 441650. And when you review those, it actually gives guidelines that the Department of Human Services and what a law enforcement agency shall do once this report is made.
So that goes through that. Okay, that helps me quite a bit.
Colleagues, I'm going to ask the detective if you have anything. I don't know if you were finished with your testimony, but if you want to finish your testimony, I'd like you to do that. I'd like to hear from our DA, and then there are several people who would like to ask a question, and Representative Gary, you will be on the list, but you won't be next.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, thank you for having me. My name is Annie Schoen. I'm from the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. I am here in support of this bill on behalf of the ODAA. I've been prosecuting elder abuse for a number of years now, probably about three. I started off prosecuting both financial and physical elder abuse, and now we've split that in our office, so I'm doing primarily physical elder abuse. I'm here pinch hitting for John Wentworth, who was on the work group. So I've been rapidly trying to bring myself up to speed, and I'd just like to address some of the concerns that were raised. One of the concerns that was raised was that we have processes in place. Why are those processes not working? And the reality of the situation is those processes aren't working because they're way too difficult and complicated, especially for financial records. Right now, it is harder to get financial records than it is to get medical records. In order to get comprehensive financial records, you basically have to go to, without notice, you have, without giving notice to the person whose account it is, you have to go to a judge and ask for a waiver of that, which is basically like writing a warrant. So right now, if you want to get financial records without tipping off the suspect, you have to pretty much write a warrant, and that's more than you have to do even to get protected health information. Another concern was that, you know, if someone were to go get these records, do what Representative Frederick was worried about, a line officer, what's the remedy? Well, frankly, the remedy would be that the evidence would be tainted and probably excluded at trial, and that officer would not be investigating these for very much longer. I mean, the whole point of investigating these first is to make, of course, the elder victim whole, but also to try to get accountability from the offender. So there is a remedy if someone were to do that. And one of the other issues that was raised was why not just go through a warrant process or go get a subpoena. And I can tell you practically when a detective called me late at night and says, I have this victim in the hospital, and probably the most common situation is she is suffering from horrible, horrible pressure ulcers or bed sores, and we just don't know. I can't tell. Is that abuse? Those occur in the elderly all the time. Is this a situation of abuse, or is this a situation where, frankly, it's a caregiver doing their best and this just happened? They can't really talk to the nurses or the doctors. They're not authorized to talk to them. I don't know what to tell them. We can't just subpoena those records in the middle of the night, and frankly, at that point, the officer's got a reasonable belief that something is going on. He's got a reasonable belief that he's got a victim in a lot of pain. It's not normal for someone to have these kind of injuries, but he doesn't know, more likely or not, to a probable cause standard, whether or not those injuries are caused criminally. So it's situations like that, a patient in the ER, or a situation where we've got a family member saying that grandma is missing large sums of money and they don't know where they're going, and grandson has access to her account because he's put himself on the account, and can you look into this? It may not rise to probable cause. It certainly gives the officer a reasonable belief that something is up, and then the officer at that point could contact the bank and discuss that with them. If we've got to wait to get a subpoena or a warrant, that simply would not happen, and frankly, it could give the perpetrator enough time to take that money out of grandma's account. That money is gone. We do not recover that type of money ever. These victims are just left penniless and, in the physical abuse cases, very injured. The last thing I'd like to say is that according to the National Committee for the Prevention of Elder Abuse, 84% of elder abuse goes unreported. So we are getting just a tiny fraction of the abuse reported, and then we are getting an even tinier fraction of this abuse prosecuted. So in the end, we're doing everything we can, putting every measure in place with this bill to give us the means and the ability to go after the perpetrators, stop the abuse as quickly as possible, and prosecute the offenders.
Colleagues, I'm going to allow questions, but if we can, keep our speeches to a minimum and our questions pointed. Representative Wand.
We are not allowed to fall below the constitutional standard by statute, and so any fishing expeditions would be violating the Fifth Amendment. It would not be admissible. Is that still correct if we pass this bill? Or if not the Fifth Amendment, the other one.
You certainly...
The other one? The other one. It's been a while.
Thank you, Governor Perry.
Representative, no, we are not allowed to fall below the standard of the Constitution, and yes, it would be excluded if you did so.
Thank you.
Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you talk a little bit more, since you were in the work group, Mr. Smith, about the issues around notice to the hypothetical victim? I can imagine in some cases the reason you wouldn't want to try to give it is because you'll alert the person who's committing the wrongdoing, but this is obviously a big sticking point on the bill. Can you just tell us more about what that discussion was and how we ended up with the language that's in the bottom of page 2 about how the bank may but is not required to inform the customer before releasing the information?
The reason being is in many instances, the victims are being victimized by people who either have power of attorney over them or may even be added to the checking accounts themselves. Sure. As a result of that, making notifications to the victim may at the same time be inadvertently notifying the suspect that an abuse investigation is occurring in the first place. We left that language in there for the off chance if there was a significant safety issue in place. The safety of the victim is paramount.
Okay. I'll keep it in. Thank you,
Representative.
So, okay, Detective Smith, because you're in the work group, I'm going to rely on you, and of course, I'm showing you're welcome. As to Section 10, Paragraph 2B, that the law enforcement agency has a reasonable belief that abuse has occurred or is occurring, is the intent there that the level of suspicion be analogous to that currently used in child abuse investigations?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. This is interesting, and most people don't see the crimes, these crimes that are committed, don't have any idea about some of the evil people that are in the world. And while I want to be sure that we do protect privacy and so on, I'm really appreciate the work that you're doing to come up with something. Just recently, this past weekend, I was told that an acquaintance of mine is moving his mother closer to his house because he's just discovered when she was unable to pay her bills that his brother's stepson, who's 30 years old and has never worked, has been borrowing money from Granny.
Mm-hmm.
And Granny now has no money, so we're going to have somebody look into that here real soon, too. But these are the kind of cases that I know you see and that everybody wants to protect. People who are questioning the access and so on are doing so, with the right intentions. I don't think anybody has bad intentions here on any of these points. Thank you.
Thank you for that comment.
And thank you both for your testimony. Colleagues, I want to move on to the department. A couple of people have been very helpful to us. Fred Steele and Jeff Aiken have worked with us all through the protective team that I spoke about that the director pulled together, and all through this work group as well. Thank you for giving up your evening one more time and being with us. Please identify and enlighten us.
I'm Jeff Aiken with the Department of Human Services.
And I'm so sorry. And Joe, would you come up? Joe Green, would you come up as well?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Jeff Aiken with the Department of Human Services Background Check Unit. I'm here to testify in support of this bill and the Dash 2 amendments, as well as express my appreciation, honor for being a member of the Elder Abuse Work Group. I want to bring your attention just to a couple of sections, specifically Section 17, which updates the Never Never Crimes list. In addition to updating some of those crimes to becoming five-year disqualifiers and then being subject to the Wayne test after that period, we've added a number of other crimes that tend to indicate behaviors that could potentially put individuals at risk, those crimes being child neglect in the first degree, forgery in the first degree, animal abuse in the first degree, and aggravated animal abuse in the first degree. Those would be permanently disqualifying for individuals applying to provide care to individuals in a care setting. Sections 18 and 19 of this bill amends statutes 181, 534, and 537. And when in 2009, when 443.004 was passed as a law that introduced the Never Never Crimes list, it was written in a manner that allowed these individuals the full Wayne test and right to request an appeal of their fitness determination, although the law also stated that the public funds may never be used in support of their employment. So it was kind of a fallacy of due process for them. And so what 18 and 19 do in this is support the Never Never Crime list by basically stating that if an individual is found to have a conviction of one of these crimes, they would not be able to provide care in this setting and would not be given an appeal right. Based on that, their due process would be in seeking expungement or other means of cleaning their record. That is my testimony. I'm welcome to entertain any questions.
Okay, we'll finish the panel and we'll have questions. Next, please.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Fred Steele. I am the manager for our Community Adult Protective Services Unit at the Department of Human Services. I was also a member of the Elder Abuse Work Group. I want to at least take a second to praise the leadership of Representative Gilliam and Representative Hoyle in this work group. Despite the questions that are being raised tonight, there are a lot of really good elements in this bill that Adult Protective Services and the Department of Human Services would like to see passed so that we can better address elder abuse and ideally prevention of abuse in our seniors and our elderly in Oregon. Again, that leadership of Gilliam, Representatives Gilliam and Hoyle has been just superb. As far, you know, and again, so from the Department of Human Services, Adult Protective Services, despite being pulled out of in the Dash 2s, the medical records and financial records components and the ability to have access or a little clearer access to those records, we still support the bill. However, I do want to speak to those components because of the questions that are being raised. First, the issue of vulnerability and the line that's being drawn at the age of 65. That line that is drawn, at least from the DHS perspective and our administrative approach to abuse, that line is more about drawing a line of when we have to respond. We get an allegation of abuse, and as long as that definition of abuse is met within that allegation, as the person is 65 or even a person that is disabled under the age of 65, we respond. Now, where our limitations are that are built into statute and built into rule are to look at that vulnerability. How do we actually want to provide a protective service to an individual that might be abused? If a person has full capacity and they tell us to, I realize this is occurring, there is no neglect here, I have full understanding of the situation. My bank records, you can't have access to them because I am very aware that I am giving my niece all of my money. I have put her on the deed to my house. There's not much more we can do or will do. They have that independence. And that comes from, just a quick education on Chapter 410. So the first line, the first sentence of that chapter that tells how we as a state are going to address seniors and people with disabilities in Oregon. And it's the policy of the state, and it's the policy that the Department of Human Services starts with in anything we do, including our investigations and our protective services. It says the older citizens of this state are entitled to enjoy their later years in health, honor, and dignity, and citizens with disabilities are entitled to live lives of maximum freedom and independence. The investigations that we conduct into abuse start there more than they start at that age of 65. The age of 65 tells us to respond and to start asking questions, but it's that independence, trying to preserve self-determination of an individual that we're really trying to preserve in our investigations and in our protective services that we provide. So when you look at the medical records pieces and the financial records pieces that are in this bill, or at least that were in the introduced bill with the department's ability to work more closely with our healthcare providers and within the stipulations of HIPAA, and to work more closely with our banks and credit unions within the allowances of preserving that dignity and honor of the potential victim in an abuse allegation, that deference to independence is where we start. So it wouldn't be a free-for-all in having access to the records. It really gets to trying to address the most vulnerable, the ones that have diminished capacity and can't consent to us to provide or to have access to their records, and those that are basically lost control of their records, their information. Basically, you have a situation where a perpetrator has gained that control, whether through a legal tool of a conservatorship, guardianship, power of attorney, having their name on the account, the deed to a house. Oftentimes it's not a legal tool, it's just undue influence, which is very difficult to look into and prove. But we have tools that we use to be able to assess those situations. That's the overriding from a department standpoint, the overriding threshold that we try to meet before and would meet if we had access to financial and medical records before we would begin asking for those through the allowances that were in the introduced bill. However, with them being pulled out, we are starting to work more closely with law enforcement. I've been working with them much more closely in the last 2 years than we ever have, and that's a result of some legislation that some of you, I believe, voted for in 2009 that is allowing us to work more closely with our DAs and our law enforcement at the county level. This information will be able to allow us to still coordinate, but put it more into that legal realm with law enforcement. However, from the department, we do look forward to, if we had more time this session, it would be wonderful, but probably 2013, to be able to address the department's ability to access these records in a more legal realm if we were given that opportunity.
Mr. Chair?
Oh. Representative Greenlee.
Representative Greenlee.
Yeah, I said Help me understand your position that anybody over 65 is vulnerable. I mean, you had 2,000 claims that were validated of elder abuse last year. There are 500,000 citizens over 65. Is it now DHS's job to take over our lives, to have access to our records, to just because we're 65? I mean, does that make us vulnerable in your eyes? I think you said it did. I just want to...
Co-chair is Representative Greenlake. No. I was hoping to address that and maybe needed to be a little clearer. It's very much that honor, dignity, and independence of where we start. And we're obligated to start there by the policy of the state in Chapter 410 that overrides even our elder abuse investigations. That 65 delineation is just about responding so we can go talk to the victim. If we had for example, if you'd written in a definition of what vulnerable is with additional elements, the department would be forced to meet those elements before we could even respond to an abusive situations. This way, with just a clear line at 65 or somebody with a disability, we can at least respond and have the authority to respond to ask the questions of a victim. But once they have that capacity and independence and it's clear, and there's a lot of deference to clarity of capacity, we back off if they don't want us there.
And you can't respond to disabled if they're under 65. I'm sorry. Yes.
Co-chairs, Representative Greenlake. No, we do respond. We will respond and do respond to a person with a disability under the age of 65. That's a mandate under Chapter 410, and actually not in our elder abuse statute in Chapter 124. We will respond, but again, it's more we start with the victim and find out what the situation is that they are concerned with, whether it's a verbal abuse, emotional abuse that they might be subject to, especially, and regardless in a long-term care facility setting, we respond. All residents we respond to. There is no age minimum or maximum there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Co-chairs, members of the Joint Committee, my name is Joe Greenman. I'm legal counsel with the Oregon Healthcare Association. On behalf of our over 600 long-term care facility members, I would just like to thank Co-Chair Gilliam and Representative Hoyle, who were the co-chairs of the Elder Abuse Work Group, for the same great work that Mr. Steele just talked at length about, so I won't belabor that point too much. Oregon Healthcare Association supports this legislation. Definitely would like to echo the provision that Mr. Aiken made reference to regarding the expunction provisions regarding criminal mistreatment in the first and second degree. Being able to access that past conviction information about those two crimes specifically was brought forward in the work group, and those two crimes are illustrative of potential red flags and troubled areas when you are looking at a potential employee who's going to be providing care for a senior or a person with disability in a care facility. So with that, I will thank the work group, thank the committee.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Co-Chair, are you satisfied?
Yes.
Colleagues, in a moment, I'm going to have our committee stand down, or what we call it, at ease for a moment. Before I do that, I want to again especially thank your committee for coming, and I'll leave it up to the co-chairs on how they want to proceed with your committee. I'd get them the heck out of here if I was.
Okay. Close the Judiciary Committee hearing on House Bill 4085, and we're adjourned.
The House Committee on Human Services is at ease for a moment. I'm going to call back to order just briefly the House Committee on Human Services, and we're going to just roll some bills over that we have to do for the record and for our rules. But before I do that, I want to make sure that everybody in this room knows how much I appreciate you being here in the evening. I appreciate all of what you've done up to this point, and I appreciate what you did today. I want to say thank you to my committee for being here on a late night session. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, for indulging this extra event. And lastly, I've said this before, I'm going to say it again. The very first meeting of this work group, Senator Winters spoke up and said, we can't do everything in one bill, but if we can move the ball down the field and come close to a standard that we now have for child abuse, we will have done something. I think that's what we're trying to do, and I just want to thank everyone for their work. I know there are lots of issues and lots of points that we need to discuss and so forth, but we are getting there. I'm proud of the work group. I'm pleased with the testimony, and I am with that going to thank you and say I am holding over on behalf of the committee for work sessions the following bills: 4165 on the early learning, 4083 regarding the lottery, 4084 on elder abuse that we discussed tonight. Those will be held over to our next meeting on Friday, February 10th, 2012. And with that, I will adjourn the House Committee on Human Services.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.